It's Helping Hand, weekly feature on HPR. Every Friday afternoon, Helping Hand puts a spotlight on an organization, topic, or event that offers assistance to the disabled and to others among the most vulnerable. I'm Dave Lawrence. Thanks for joining us. This week, we are learning about the IHS, a returning guest, Institute for Human Services. They are one of the leading organizations in the effort to help the homeless in Hawaii, where the United States' most severe homeless crisis per capita exists. Today, we are welcoming spokesperson for IHS, Kimo Carvalho. Did I say that right?
Yes, sir.
And his first appearance here joining us on Helping Hand. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You are very welcome. First, explain from your perspective, because there are a lot of organizations and certainly people in the Honolulu area might have a better idea who IHS is than people around the state. And believe it or not, I run into people in Honolulu who have no idea that we have the homeless crisis we do. Shocking it may be. Well-to-do folks who live in huge houses, and they're, really? And I think, how could you even have listened to the thing I do on the radio and you're not aware? So sometimes people are just don't know. So IHS, from where you stand, explain how you guys fit in.
So we are Hawaii's oldest, largest, and probably now the most comprehensive homeless service agency that is focused exclusively on ending and preventing homelessness in Hawaii. And, you know, just to kind of put into context where we fit into that system that you mentioned, you know, there are many providers, and we do partner with more than 80 of them, actually, on an annual basis. So we are sort of like the emergency room, so to speak, of the homeless service industry. So we are the boots on the ground guys who are developing relationships with clients. We're the safety net when you're in an emergency, a homeless emergency. You know, you come to us, and we're the safety net. So you start there, and then from there, you know, kind of get stabilized, triage, and then from there get connected to all the specialty services that involves all the different nonprofits that I'm sure that you connect with on a regular basis.
And that's Partners in Care is the consortium that you guys are part of.
Correct. We are part of Partners in Care. You know, so we do offer the spectrum, the continuum, a lot of different options. So we have emergency shelters, and we are actually diversifying our shelters to be a little bit more specialized to the different types of clients. So we have, you know, say you're a homeless person that's being discharged from the hospital. We now have medical respite homes. We have Hale Maliola, the new Sand Island shelter that assists homeless with pets, homeless couples, homeless living in their cars, oftentimes just needing a fast track navigation into housing. So we're, you know, we also have a vet home, a respite home for people with addictions that are enrolled in outpatient treatment program. So we have all these different shelter options now to be a little bit more tailored to your individualized situation.
In all, where are the services located and how many of them? It's incredible, all these specialties. How many of these locations are there and where are they?
So we have 8 shelter locations, actually, and you know, we've grown quite a bit in the last few years. And, you know, our 2 main emergency shelters are actually located in Iwale. And those 2 facilities are the women and family shelter is sort of right by the Iwale Costco, and then the Sumner Men's Shelter is right by the old Kmart, now CVS Longs. And so we have those 2 facilities. We have an employment housing office just next to the women and family shelter. Hale Maliola is at Sand Island, and our respite homes are through Kalihi and Makiki.
It's unbelievable, really. the way that you guys are funded, how is that done?
So 70% of our funding actually comes from government and all 3 levels of government, so federal, state, and city. And then the other 30% is actually private donations from foundations, corporations, and individuals like you. And so we really do, you know, rely on a lot of financial support. And sometimes just having that private support allows us to invest in innovation and be creative with innovative solutions and demonstrate success in those areas like we did in Waikiki. And from there, you know, we can then sell it to the government, and hopefully the government can sustain those efforts long term.
The what year did you say the organization's been around for how long?
So we actually turned 40 next year, and we've come a long way. We went from just being, you know, just primarily meals and shelter programs. So we now have this diverse array of homeless services. So we have employment support programs, housing support programs. We have case managers. Case managers are like life coaches. They help navigate you through this complex bureaucratic system, get you connected to social services, healthcare services. We have healthcare. We have health clinics on site so that we can actually get people access to treatment programs as quickly as possible. We have daily meal steal. We actually still also have food drop centers. So all the services in-house necessary to end and prevent anyone's homeless situation.
And when it started, it was designed for homelessness in 1978.
Exactly. Yeah. So we, you know, I think Father Claude Dutille, you know, our philosophy and mission was really just to connect with other people that are experiencing the same trauma, grief, and loss, like, you know, like yourself. And by connecting with them and developing a relationship and really, you know, on just breaking bread, literally sharing a meal and a cup of coffee and getting to know each other. And, you know, together as a community, they can really get out of their homeless situation together. And so it started with that philosophy and mission and really grew to what became IHS today.
And it must have been a really different, when thinking about the latest point in time count and then thinking about that, I mean, it's just really humbling. 1978, I try to imagine where I was in 1978, and I think this organization has been tackling essentially the same problem, which has only grown far worse. And then in since 2002, which is when I emerged here, I mean, the place doesn't look anything like it did from that moment. I mean, nothing. It is so different. And I came from Boston, which one would assume, you hear the name Boston, you think that's a rough place. There's got to be some bad stuff. The scene can't be an easy town, right? You know, the Grateful Dead, you say, even the rats have leather jackets when they play the garden. But compared to what you see now in Honolulu, this is the roughest thing I've ever seen. So when we think about the point in time count, and I hear a lot of enthusiasm from government officials about a drop in some areas of the state, And that's to be applauded. But in the population center of Honolulu, what's changed?
Well, I think, you know, just to put some context, I think really what's changed in the last 40 years is that there's been an evolution of homelessness. So, you know, the type of homeless person that we were dealing with 40 years ago might have been sort of like your, you know, somebody who would get high on marijuana and, you know, come to sleep on our beaches and just want to chill out, but they oftentimes could actually get out of homelessness quicker. Mm. And today, you know, we've had this kind of a convergence of so many different trends. So we've lost 40,000 affordable housing units in the last three decades. You know, we have an ICE epidemic. We had COFA migration of Micronesians that travel here under the Compact of Free Association. We have a mental health institution that has just been dismantled. We have poor discharge planning from, you know, the hospitals and public safety. And so all these convergence of trends that have just come together, it has just created a crisis. And so we're really dealing with all these different types of homeless subpopulations. And, you know, while we are definitely proud of the progress that we're making and we are seeing those numbers being reflected in the point in time count, at the end of the day, you know, for providers like IHS, we're doing a great job at moving thousands of people out of homelessness every year and into permanent housing and preventing more from falling in. But until you prevent more people from falling into the system than we can move out, you're still going to see a crisis and those numbers will still continue to grow.
And it really is a big crisis. Is expanding the area of the sit-lie zones helping people to get housing?
Well, it depends on the community. You know, so we were the only homeless provider actually that advocated for sit-lie law when we piloted it in Waikiki. And, you know, we don't just go out and advocate for these enforcement measures without at least trying first. So we're talking about communities where people are just constantly refusing services for, we're talking, you know, Dave, like 30, 40, 50 encounters a year. And, you know, after a while, you know, that's our taxpayer dollars that is just being wasted on a person that's just not engaging with us and receiving services. So sometimes you just need a little bit of that nudge from an enforcement officer that basically says, hey, look, you know, you're not allowed to be sleeping or laying or sitting on a sidewalk, but, you know, are you okay? Are you homeless? And if you say yes, and you are, then they at that point can say, well, you know, I have to warn you, you're not allowed to do this. So that becomes a warning. But it also becomes a referral to IHS. They actually say, well, look, you know, IHS is here in town and, you know, if you need help, they're here to offer that. And we also did that with the private sector. We partnered with all the hotel security guards, the parking lot attendants, the businesses. And, you know, instead of kicking them out of their lobbies and garages and whatnot, they instead referred them. So it really became this robust referral system that has kind of become this carrot and stick model. Mm-hmm. And it was really a handoff to getting people interested in new services. And, you know, just educating them that there's options and that they really needed to take responsibility for their lives instead of just sitting on sidewalks. So we did advocate for the Sit-Lie law. It has been effective in Waikiki. We're really proud of the success in Waikiki. We've moved, you know, more than 600 people off the streets in just the last 2.5 years. And, you know, we went into that really understanding the different homeless subpopulations and design tools like a shuttle, airline relocation programs, the very unique services that were tailored to that community, mm-hmm. in addition to Sit-Lie law. So it wasn't just one tool that moves people off the streets. It also was kind of a package deal. And we're doing the same thing now with the Evilay community. You know, I think this community, however, they're really going out of their way to refuse services. You know, they're actually going into dangerous areas on the neutral ground of Nimitz Highway and, you know, along different properties that are just really dangerous. They're right next to cars and traffic, and we're worried. But they're really doing as much as possible to avoid us. And so sometimes we have to wonder, you know, do they want services? And, you know, for our community, what does that mean?
And some of it also comes down to, like you mentioned it, in the convergence of factors that has led to this, that has contributed to this. And part of that has been the lack of service. And it's a delicate, difficult area when it comes to mental health. And when can you intervene in someone's life when they're clearly harming themselves, not able to take care of themselves, and you see so much of that, it seems like it's a very gray area.
And I think really what it comes down to, you know, we're in communication, and it's very similar to just identifying your target audience, understanding the insights. What do you know about them? What are their behaviors like? And try to connect with them on that level. For the mentally ill population, though, you know, that to what you're saying, we went from giving them absolutely no rights so that, you know, back in the day, we were able to civilly commit them. Mm-hmm. We treated them. At the time, the meds were just, you know, not really as great as they are today. But we have now, you know, the pendulum has swung so much to the rightward. We've now given them so much human rights that they can now actually be mentally ill on the streets, not knowing that they're sick, and continue to refuse treatment. And it's not until they commit a crime or they do harm to others or themselves do we actually do something about it. And that's not right, because they don't know they're sick.
Right.
So, Dave, you know, the thing about that population, though, is, you know, we continue to go to government and we continue to advocate for new laws and new policies that do allow us to intervene. And so we did go to the ledge, and we have a new option available. It's called assisted community treatment, where we can go to family court and get a court order to actually take a psychiatrist and an outreach team out into the field and treat someone who's mentally ill to the point where they actually understand, you know, that they are homeless and on the streets. And at that point, they actually do make the decision to say, you know, I didn't even know this. So, yes, I want to go into housing. I want to get off the streets. And it's we're talking people who have been homeless for, you know, 2-3 decades. It's a very long time. And it's so sad, because when they get off the streets, they don't even realize that, you know, their whole lives have passed them by. Their friends are gone. You know, their careers, it's no longer an opportunity. And so they do, you know, we have to watch out that they're not going to become too depressed and revert back to homelessness or drugs or alcohol, but, you know, hopefully transition them back into the community. And we as a community need to be receiving of them and show them that we are welcoming and loving and able to help them, you know, assimilate back into the society.
That's a really good point.
And that's just mentally ill people.
Right. No, I mean, the crisis is huge.
Yeah.
and I just look at that as a gigantic area of, because like the other night I was walking home, I guess it was Memorial Day night, and stopped to get some half and half at the ABC store. I live in Waikiki. Mm-hmm. And there was a homeless woman sort of camped in the store at the door and pleading with the staff there, like, I'm a homeless vet. I need help. And the woman at the counter, I got into a conversation with the staff member. She's like, I don't know what to do or something. I said, well, it's true. I said, she called IHS. She said, oh, Institute Human, you know, she knew the name. I said, yeah, Institute for Human Services. I said, because this person needs help, you know, so, and tell them where your store is, and hopefully they'll send somebody down here.
And that's exactly what we do. You know, if we get a phone call from a business owner like that, that is exactly what our homeless outreach team does. They go out to meet you where you are. They go out into the streets and, you know, we cannot know where to go find people unless the community right. tells us where they are. And, you know, just that intelligence of like, you know, this specific store and, you know, doorway at this specific yeah. time in this community is enough for us to say, okay, we're going to get our vehicle and a team and we're going to go.
That's well, I had to, after 3 years, 4 years almost doing Helping Hand, I did know what to tell the woman.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, and I told her they will come. You have to just tell them where you are and what's going on. But yeah, it's,
there's still a lot more to do in Waikiki. And, you know, I think, you have to continue to adapt, you know, as a business, you know, we're a private nonprofit organization, but, you know, we kind of operate like a business. In any business, you have to adapt to the changing climate of the community. And right now we're in Waikiki, we're seeing exactly that, you know, people with substance abuse or mental illnesses. And so we're adapting our services to now be a little bit more focused on them.
And one final question before we get into how we can help you guys.
Sure.
There's been this perception, it really depends on which homeless service provider you talk to, because as you've pointed out, there are different demographics of homeless, and some homeless service providers deal with a different demographic and a different sort of reality of where they come from. When it comes to the demographic you deal with, sometimes you'll hear this, people in Hawaii say they came from somewhere else, they should go home. And that's always a strange thing in the United States, because I'm like, well, let's take five steps back. Are you Cherokee, Navajo? Are you on the mainland? Unless you're one of those tribes, then you came here. And then when it comes to Hawaii, there are very few people who can really claim to actually, you know, it's like, because you were born here. So that is it all right then? A white guy who was born here has been, or whatever other race, you know. So when it comes to the homeless, and when you're not from here, maybe you take defense of the homeless when this issue comes up. People say they're coming from somewhere else. When you look at your overall population and you tell me how it is, Kimo, are they, what's it roughly the percentage of the folks that you guys deal with at IHS, how many of them are not from Hawaii?
So it's less than 10% of our overall homeless population here on Oahu is recent arrivals. We're talking less than a year. So less than 10%. At IHS specifically, we probably get about maybe on average 150 to 200 a year. And you would not believe how many people we prevent from coming here, though. They actually call us because we're very near to the airport. And so they'll say, hey, you know, I'm actually arriving in Honolulu on this day. You know, can I please book a bed at the shelter? Can I, you know, have housing services? Can I, we do our best to discourage that, because our local safety net really should be for our homeless population. We have a crisis here and we really need to, you know, fix our own community first. And but, you know, it happens anyway. And, you know, for those people, we do have a mainland fee, because we want to, you know, educate them and say, look, you know, if you're going to come here to Hawaii to be homeless, okay, you have to come here and be contributing members to our community. Mm-hmm. But you're going to pay a mainland fee that is the equivalent to a hostel in Waikiki. So you have to come here understanding, you know, at least some kind of self-sufficiency and contribution to our community, and really understand that you're going to have to get out of homelessness, not be homeless. So
sure.
We try to work that message into educating people before they get here. But if they get here, there's actually two types of recent arrivals from the mainland. Those who actually come here not really understanding our high cost of living and how difficult it is to get employment. So they come here with maybe like, you know, $5,000-$7,000 in their pockets. They get into housing, but they run out of money very fast, and then they get stuck here and they can't get back home. And then there's those who actually do make a choice to come here to be homeless. And oftentimes they are dealing with some kind of grief, some kind of mental illness, or something that's really just getting them wanting to escape their home state. A lot of people will say that, you know, homeless people are being shipped here from the mainland by other governments. That is not true. Our outreach team has asked all those recent arrivals, you know, how did you pay to get here?
Right.
And the best thing we can correlate to that is that they're using their state benefits, their home state benefits, to pay for those one-way tickets here.
Yeah. And it's also hard to, I mean, we're human beings, and over thousands and thousands of years, our societal norms have evolved. There was a point when people were very nomadic, and so it's very difficult to say, no, you don't have the right to do. You know, it's very strange when one person tells them, you know, because on behalf of them, you start to realize, wow, you know, I'm just one of 8 billion, And it's like, who are these other folks to tell me, you know, what I'm supposed to do while I'm trapped on this planet, especially if I'm not breaking the law, especially if they say, I'll come work for you. I'll work in your kitchen. I'll scrub your floors. I just want to live in Hawaii.
And that's fine. If you want to come here to Hawaii, absolutely. We welcome the talent to move here, but you have to contribute to our community.
Exactly.
You have to be not – you. Cannot be sitting on the sidewalk and squatting and expecting to
services.
Extract resources from us taxpayer dollars. It's one thing if you're off the grid and you're not, you know, doing anything to anyone, but then when you're actually expending resources that really should be for our local community. We have other issues like education and air conditioning systems in schools and all these other issues.
We have massive issues. I mean, it's just you look at the schools, they look like a building from, I mean, the worst school that I would see growing up in the Philly area looks like a palace compared to the best schools here that aren't private. Uh-huh. And which is shocking because it's kind of like when you visit Jamaica and you get there and you see nothing but the worst kind of poverty. The worst kind of poverty you've ever seen, chickens running in the road, holes everywhere, cows, just, I mean, people trying to sell anything on the side of the road, no running water, and then you show up, you pull up to this resort, and the road to get to the resort is a piece of junk for 2 hours, and somehow these shiny resorts can exist, but nobody's figured out a way to tax those things. Oh, you're going to have people come and pay $500 a night to stay here, but there's no money going back into the roads for the local people.
Right.
So I look at that. So to me, I never thought I'd ever see the comparison between Jamaica and Hawaii, but there's obviously a huge one, especially when you look at the schools. That's where I really, and it hurts, because you're like, wow, I don't get this. You built the Ritz. You let them have a pass to have this building block all these residents' views, go against all these Waikiki guidelines that are in writing not to build a building like that, but yet you let the schools look like this. The kids are going, they don't even have AC. It's like 90 degrees, and the school looks like a building from who knows when. So I get that. I mean, to me, it's like, you know, if you come here, you should definitely, I totally understand, you should have... you plan on contributing like you would
values.
Anywhere.
It's values.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
I mean, I think that goes back to what I meant. The nomadic lifestyle does not mean that you're going to go necessarily be stealing or taking things from everywhere. It just means you'll be working and moving and maybe not own a place and just keep moving. And I'm not defending because I don't know. I don't have any judgment on any of it. I just feel so bad when I see all the issues, you know, just from the outside, you feel very, like you don't even know what to, like you said, there are so many populations, and just talking about the mental health issue is such a deep dive.
Yeah.
And then you realize, wow, that's just one part of a huge, huge puzzle. So you guys, you've got the, you know, you got a spot here, you're on Helping Hand, it's a bunch of people, very affluent people, with incredible things in their lives, you know, who are tuned into this show. So what, of all the things that you could ask for, people can give you money, donate some real estate for you, be on your board, free medical help for these people, supplies, food, whatever it is, you know best, ask for it.
Well, I think, you know, for our homeless community who's listening, we ask that, you know, they trust us and they engage in options and solutions and opportunities. And, you know, if there's options that don't work for them, talk to us about them and, you know, ask us how, you know, we can help you. That's really all we want to do. And then for, you know, the community at large, really, actually, I could ask for two things. One, because we talked about it earlier, refer homeless people that you know. If you tell us where they are, who they are, and you have that existing relationship with them, especially, that handoff could make, you know, all the difference in their lives. And we encourage the community to not, you know, offer them free resources on the streets because it actually sustains their homelessness. Instead, you know, work with us and channel your compassion into more responsible giving habits that allow us to really get them motivated to come off the streets. And the second thing for the community at large is to partner with us. You know, we are very collaborative. We offer our partners opportunities to collaborate, but if there's other opportunities that others see and options that we should consider as IHS to really help the community at large, we just want to partner. We really want to, you know, be part of our community. It's not an IHS job and responsibility. It's a community problem and a community crisis, and it's going to take a community to solve this. And so it takes partnerships and collaboration, and that's really what we want to do. So those are my two asks for the community at large. And then for the homeless clients, we really just want to, you know, figure out more ways to work with you and develop that trust and really help you get off the streets and into housing. That's what's going to and your homelessness is housing. We really need housing.
So to follow up what Kimo just said, 24 hours a day, if somebody runs into a homeless person in crisis, like the example I gave with the ABC store, should they call 447-2800?
Absolutely. We are a 24/7 emergency shelter. That is one of the three portals to access services. So you can call our shelter anytime, and you know, we can at least get you started on the process, or we can send an outreach team to meet you the next day or offer you any solutions or options right there.
And also on the partnership. So the people at that store become partners in a way when they pick up the phone, or myself. So from now on, I'm gonna learn from this session myself. And be like, well, you know what? Next time I'll mention that to the store attendant, but I'll take it upon myself to pick up the phone afterwards and say, hey, this is what I just said. And I thought about it and I didn't.
No worries. Yeah, I think, you know, that phone number, our email, info@ihs-hawaii.org, you know, that's the way to just communicate with us. And, you know, our staff are trained to actually triage those calls or the emails so that we're connecting them with the right department that can follow up with those individualized inquiries. And if it's a partnership, that's typically me that follows up. If not me, one of our other directors at IHS.
So that's one of the important things about this is call when you see a homeless person in crisis. If you can, call IHS. It's 808-447-2800. They're online at ihshawaii.org. You can email them, too, if you have a lot of supplies, some real estate, anything, some money you want to donate to them, ideas for partnerships, ways to help them out, because it's such a huge struggle and it's going to take so many agencies, so much money and compassion and empathy. info@ihs-hawaii.org for the email. All their contact information, the full interview, the radio feature, and all of our other Helping Hand segments can be listened to, and all the information acquired at hawaiipublicradio.org. Just look for Helping Hand on the pull-down menu on the front page. We talked about a lot in a short period of time today. Is there anything, you know, you're very good. I see why you're the spokesperson for them, because you can really float a lot of issues. Anything else that we didn't cover that's important, please add it.
You know, I think that, you know, we really just want to educate, you know, I think a lot of people have this willingness, I'm sure, especially the listeners who are listening right now, they're listening because they want to figure out how to engage. And what I encourage the community to do as well is just get educated on the issue. If you become educated, you know how to engage in your own special way. Everyone has a role. And I think that's really, you know, where it starts. You can become educated by volunteering, by just actually calling me and having this dialogue on a one-on-one basis, touring IHS, listening to our media broadcasts just to understand more about all these different issues and all the different homeless subpopulations. But if you really get educated, I think, you know, then the community understands how to engage.
And you have a lot of volunteer opportunities, I'm assuming.
Absolutely. All those different departments that I mentioned, they all require volunteers. And we're built on a volunteer network, so we're really trying to get more.
And that's a great way to do it. And you're also volunteering when you pick up the phone to call them when you see a person in crisis. So you don't have to think, oh, I don't have a lot of time. I'm really busy. I'm taking care of my mom or whatever.
Absolutely.
I totally get that. So, you know, that's one of the big takeaways from this. So we can all try to do that. And that is helping that person you see immensely.
That's the helping hand.
Yeah. I mean, it really is, because you're reaching out by doing that. And 24/7, they're there for you. Kimo Carvalho, spokesperson for the Institute for Human Services, IHS, legendary name in the islands for doing good. No, it's like one of these huge rock brands that sometimes we have on the show, and you
Thank
think,
you.
Wow, that's a huge name, you know, and it's like IHS. I think of, like, if I was in those people's shoes, you guys would be like rock stars to me. So thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you so much.